Welcome back to The Breakdown with me, NLW. It's a daily podcast on macro, Bitcoin, and the big picture power shifts remaking our world. What's going on, guys? It is Friday, May 3rd, and that means it's time for the Friday Five. Before we get into that, however, if you're enjoying The Breakdown, please go subscribe to it, give it a rating, give it a review, or if you want to dive deeper into the conversation, come join us on the Breakers Discord. You can find a link in the show notes or go to bit.ly/breakdownpod. Hello, friends, back with another countdown of the most important events in crypto this week. We've got some big obvious highlights, CZ being sentenced, Roger Ver being arrested. We've also got some macro talk. But overall, it does sort of feel like the beginning of a summer week. Summers around these parts tend to be a little quieter, almost like they're forcing us to go touch grass. And this week had all the hallmarks of that subtlety. It's not that stuff didn't happen, and it's not that the stuff that did happen wasn't important. It just wasn't this blistering, wave you around, smack you up and down kind of importance that we've been used to over the last couple months. Despite all that, I think there are some super interesting conversations in here. So without any further ado, let's dive in.
Weird week, man.
It is weird. It's weird. It's sort of not good, not bad. It's just whatever, I guess. We could have slept through this one.
Yeah, is the whatever a preview of what we get in a post-halving cycle summer leading up to an election where everything kind of ramps up in September and October and yeah. It's just extremely boring, confusing, and go touch some grass?
Unfortunately, I think so. We were just joking. It's going to be the Friday 1.5 for a couple months. But you know what? We are very good at drawing deep meaning out of non-events. So I'm sure we'll be just fine.
Water from a stone. Yeah, well, let's start drawing it right now. I think that the first story obviously has to be Powell in general, his views on inflation, no stag, no inflation, and of course, the new job numbers that rolled in today, which because we live in the upside down, some are viewing as good, some are viewing as bad, but just take a look. Just in, the U.S. economy added a net 175,000 jobs in April, a solid gain, but below expectations of 250K. Healthcare was the big sector hiring. Unemployment rate, 3.9%. The unemployment rate has been below 4% for 27 months. That hasn't happened since 1967 to 1970. And wages, plus 3.9% in past year, above 3.5% inflation. So unemployment actually was supposed to be 3.8. It's 3.9. So that's a slight uptick. And we added jobs, but it's less jobs. So now the market gets to parse whether this is good or bad news. We can see the traders are already once again betting that we're going to get rate cuts based on this news and moving it up to September. Oh my gosh, man. What is going on here? More people losing jobs or not getting jobs is good because we might get a cut and that's liquidity and means the market can go up.
Yeah. I mean, listen, at the meeting this week, what stood out, a couple things. First was that the full employment mandate is back on the radar in pretty full equivalence with the inflation mandate. You know, I think that where Powell and the market sort of narrative diverged this week was the market's been picking up steam around, you know, inflation creeping back up, even the stagflation idea. And Powell sort of threw as much cold water on that as he could, mostly in the sense that he just it was pretty clear that they aren't buying the inflation return idea. You know, the reasons that it's coming back a little bit don't scare them. They sound no less committed to the 2%, you know, mandate that they're getting to. In fact, one of the parts where he got heated was when someone asked if 3% was okay. But it's pretty clear that, you know, right now they're keeping as much of an eye on unemployment as they are on inflation. And I think that they are, rather than it just being data dependent, he started to articulate this idea of paths where, you know, in one scenario, they can see cutting for this reason. In another scenario, they can see cutting for that reason. They can see staying the course for a long time. What they said is not really on the table right now, and no one is discussing, is additional rate hikes, which some people had started to discuss a little in advance. So, you know, it was a sort of nothing burger of a meeting in some ways, but the fact that it was such a stay the course meeting was significant in its own small way.
I agree. He left open more narratives to explain a future cut. But what I found more interesting was how many questions he had to answer about potential hikes. Mm-hmm. So whether he's talking about it or not, the people asking questions thought that it was a viable potential outcome that because inflation is ticking up, we could see future rate hikes. So once again, just extremely confused and mixed data across the board from around the world and the United States. I think they're really in trouble here if we start to lean towards stagflation.
I think the unemployment, this unemployment data that we just got is unfortunately for these markets who are now betting on a September, you know, cut instead of a December cut, it seems to me to completely reinforce exactly what Powell was saying, that it's slight wobbles showing up in the unemployment numbers, not that there's some big dramatic thing. I mean, the way that he described it, it would have to be dramatic. You know, it's not a miss on 250 gains, you know, but with 75,000 less jobs than we expected, we would have to see, you know, a significant uptick in unemployment, serious sort of sector level disruption. You know, this is not the thing that's going to get that cut is my point of view after that meeting.
Right. I mean, to the point of the tweet that I showed, we still have record levels of long streaks of adding jobs to the economy, whatever those jobs are. It's funny that she talks about that, you know, hasn't happened since the late 60s to the 70s, but the 70s is
what. Yeah, what came after that wasn't so good.
So I don't know if we're making a good point or not. Now, this is not something I intended to bring up, but I have to play a minute video. I'm not sure if everyone saw this. This is Jared Bernstein, the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, which is the agency that provides Biden with economic advice on domestic and international economic policy, talking about money printing in a film where he was asked a question. I don't know if you've seen this, but if you haven't, even better, because I can get your first reaction. And it should be clear, the woman who is interviewing him is not against this per se. You'll see her question, then we can unpack it. Okay.
The US government can't go bankrupt because we can print our own money.
It obviously begs the question, why exactly are we borrowing in a currency that we print ourselves? I'm waiting for someone to stand up and say, why do we borrow our own currency in the first place?
Like you said, they print the dollar. So why does the government even borrow?
Well, some of this stuff gets... some of the language and concepts are just confusing. I mean, the government definitely prints money, and it definitely lends that money, which is why the government definitely prints money, and then it lends that money by selling bonds. Is that what they do?
It's not a joke. This is real.
They sell bonds. Yeah, they sell bonds, right? Since they sell bonds, and people buy the bonds and lend them the money. Yeah, so. A lot of times, at least to my ear with MMT, the language and the concepts can be kind of unnecessarily confusing, but there is no question that the government prints money and then it uses that money to, I guess I can't really talk, I don't get it. I don't know what they're talking about, like, because it's like, the government clearly prints money, it does it all the time, and it clearly borrows. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this debt and deficit conversation. So I don't think there's anything confusing there.
Yep, that's our lead economic advisor.
There's definitely nothing confusing there.
Yeah, and you know, listen, I think Powell and Yellen may be rather intelligent and understand these concepts, but a little scary when you watch something like this. And what I wanted to say is that woman is not against money printing. She's a huge MMT homer. She actually just doesn't think we should borrow. We should just print the money and use it because she doesn't understand that that would be runaway inflation.
Yeah, Stephanie Kelton is the lead intellectual behind MMT. So one thing that I hadn't seen yet is what's the actual end product that video was in?
It's a movie about money. And I believe it's a movie about MMT, but I don't have the context either. I just saw the video, it's clickbait, but I mean, it's real. Clearly, they videoed the guy, and then he probably does another clip where he actually explains it once he's learned. But when you see it in real time, what was really happening?
It's jarring. It's jarring.
Oh man. Okay, so our second story of the day after our confused economy has to be ETFs, and specifically ETF outflows. We saw the biggest day of outflows on Wednesday, $563 million. This puts to rest the idea, at least, that nobody can sell an ETF if they bought it, right? Which apparently was the premise for our future super cycle, because money can only go in and money can't go out. That was dumb. But this was a huge outflows, obviously, during this week as we saw Bitcoin break down. And interestingly, we had stories on Bloomberg saying that this Bitcoin slump led by this led or followed by the ETF outflow is a canary in the coal mine for all markets and all risk assets. Are we so big now that we are the leading indicator of what's coming for markets and the economy?
I actually don't think it's as crazy as it sounds, and here's why. So one thing that has always been mind-boggling to me as we've debated correlation over the last couple of years, it is very clear that as more TradFi participants come into Bitcoin, correlation gets higher, particularly in moments where correlation in general in categories of assets is getting clearer. We're in a period where all of our expectations about where rate cuts were going to be and just sort of general economic health have been finally, the market has finally been accepting that it's not going to look the way that they wanted it to look. The consequence of that has been that all risk assets are sort of taking a leg down. They don't look like they have strength. You know, the only things that are sort of thriving in that area are, you know, AI related stuff, because that's the sort of the counterweight to everything. And so the reason that I think it's not insane that Bitcoin would start to act like a canary in the coal mine is that for a lot of the holders of these ETFs, it does represent the furthest end of the risk spectrum that they're on. Even if they're buying it with an unrisky type of structure in the form of an ETF, it still represents a far end of their kind of risk tolerance in their portfolio. So if in general risk tolerance is peeling back, Bitcoin's going to be the first thing to go, especially if they're low conviction, you know, just got into it for the first time, kind of non-long-term holders. So I actually do think that especially the longer that ETFs exist, the longer that Bitcoin sort of, you know, the deeper that Bitcoin gets into the existing system, the more likely it is in the short and medium term, let's call it, to sort of play this role of, you know, the furthest out thing on the risk curve for a lot of those traditional participants.
That actually makes a ton of sense. I'm not sure how many of those participants there are. So what we can draw, and the very fact that they just bought these and then immediately exited them, obviously, maybe just means they were, you know, gateway drug or trying a little bit. But what you're saying absolutely makes sense. It just goes back to the idea of Bitcoin either being a risk asset or digital gold at any given time, or maybe it's neither.
The other possibility, which, you know, some of this stuff is, I think Checkmate and Glassnode are probably having a good time trying to figure all this stuff out. But it's not impossible to me that, hold aside the sort of correlation effect with traditional markets, that crypto traders who are literally living in this 24/7, you know, can't go to sleep without there being moves, are going to be, relatively speaking, ahead of traditional markets when it comes to digesting new information. That actually wouldn't surprise me at all either. Just they have to move faster. They have to assimilate information more quickly because they never have the benefit of slowing down. It's obviously a very different demographic than the long-term holders. I mean, sometimes in the same person, you know, you can be a long-term holder and also a trader who's got, you know, different pots for different reasons. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if that group, you know, when they watch sort of shifts, like they're less likely to sort of fight against Powell, you know, like and sort of, you know, be dumb and buy into it. They're not listening to the same sort of consensus making analysts on Wall Street. So they might be on the vanguard. It wouldn't surprise me.
Interestingly, when Bitcoin did find at least this local bottom and bounce, what you saw in the market from those crypto natives was meme coins flying again and Solana rising.
Yeah.
So they're still there waiting for any little signal that it's safe to go back to the casino.
Totally.
And God bless them.
Hello, Breakers. Today's episode is sponsored by Ledger. As another cycle ramps up, it's another chance to think about your Bitcoin custody best practices, and of course, to help all the new folks do the same. Ledger is the global platform for securing Bitcoin and other crypto. Ledger combines both hardware wallets and the Ledger Live app to offer the best way to buy, sell, swap, and stake without sacrificing on security or self-custody. Ledger features cutting-edge technology in the form of a certified secure chip and a proprietary operating system, but also brings ease of use. This makes Ledger a safe and secure way to manage your digital assets without all the stress. Check out the link to the Bitcoin Ledger Nano in the show notes. 5% of all sales of the Bitcoin Ledger Nano go to support Bitcoin development. Thanks once again to Ledger for supporting The Breakdown.
Obviously, we had, as a part of this ETF story, even IBIT trading at a discount to NAV, which was interesting because we hadn't really had that before, about 1.7% discount to NAV. We have JP Morgan saying that the crypto market sell-off was driven by retail investors. No surprises there. We know that we don't have large institutions yet buying these. But to the title here, don't be fooled by Bitcoin's dip, massive upside ahead. That's coming from the fact that BlackRock has openly said they see sovereign wealth funds, pensions coming to Bitcoin ETF. So it won't just be retail in the future. Fidelity following up this morning saying pension funds exploring Bitcoin investments on ETF approval. So we have the two largest issuers, not named GBTC, saying that they are actively working with sovereign wealth and pension funds to bring the real wall of money into the ETFs.
I mean, this has been clear for a long time that there was going to be a delay between ETFs launching and sort of the full market access actually coming into full effect. You know, when it comes to Bitcoin price right now, to the extent that you believe that it is driven by larger market forces, i.e. is not a reflection of some structural weakness in Bitcoin itself or even Bitcoin markets, then there's no reason to be less optimistic over a longer time horizon. You know, as always, the game of markets is to be able to hold at the same time the, you know, the short, medium, and long term and make different decisions based on them. And, you know, I think we're just kind of living in that right now. But, you know, BlackRock's not stressing about this. I don't think Fidelity's stressing about this. I don't think anyone who made these bets and started going down this road a couple years ago to try to get to where we are now is really stressing about, you know, a short term dip.
Totally agree. And they know that it's going to take a lot of time for due diligence to get that kind of money into these products. They weren't even taking it seriously from the very beginning and are probably just starting to look now. And the final thing on ETFs was Hong Kong, because this week it was widely reported this major failure in inflows, how disappointing and horrid it was. Only $12 million came in on the first day. Apparently you don't track and report these the same way that we do in the United States. And looking at it now, a few days later, $292 million. In assets on day one. And the prediction was $1 billion in 2 years. So it got over a quarter of the way to the two-year prediction in the first day. And our industry widely reported this as a huge failure all week.
We're not always great at getting all the information before we tweet. But you know what?
We punch way
above our weight class when it comes to Twitter engagement. And you can't have one without the other, I guess.
Yeah, well, the next story we have to talk about is some big names in the industry and their legal troubles, some being resolved and some just starting. Of course, I'm talking about CZ getting 4 months in prison. And then, of course, Roger Ver, a.k.a. Bitcoin Jesus, being arrested in Spain for tax evasion. Let's talk about CZ first. As it says, CZ's trial proves it pays to cooperate. Totally different crime than SBF. But also notable, totally different strategy, totally different approach to his personal PR, totally a different approach to the judge and admitting guilt. And the guy's only going to jail for 4 months. He'll come out, and as they say, he'll probably get a hell of a lot richer while he's there.
Yep. I mean, this the whole thing has been really interesting to watch. You know, I think that CZ is the type of person who plays a strategy out all the way when he commits to a strategy. And I think that for a very long time, Binance and CZ thought they could get away, they could push the line as far as they possibly could. At some point, the tide turned, everything shifted, and he went in an opposite direction with the strategy. You know, he went basically, he played the exact opposite of the SBF sort of strategy and did it all the way. And by the way, I don't think that that means that any of the sort of shared remorse or anything like that is not real. I just mean that he kind of leaned in all the way to knowing that there was a possibility of getting jail time and just wanting to minimize it as much as humanly possible. And listen, I think in some ways, the biggest tell that CZ had accepted that the tide had turned and the times had changed was when he stepped down as CEO of Binance. I mean, this is a brand that is so inextricably connected to him that was to me an indication of just him knowing that it was a different time. And I think we saw that play out. I think it clearly worked. You know, I think that he got jail time because the US in general is trying to nudge white collar crime into the realm of having actual consequence. And, you know, crypto is sort of caught up in that a little bit. But, you know, he goes in, I think, as widely seen as the richest person to ever go to prison in the U.S. So still breaking records. And I don't think 4 months is going to do too much. Sue from Up Only fame said it was just a great way to a place to meditate for that period of time. Right.
He also, interestingly, goes to jail extremely popular.
Yeah.
Right. And so, I mean, the outpouring of letters were a part of the sentencing. Even the judge said it. I mean, from supporters, celebrities, industry leaders, he has a lot of support. A lot of people are happy he'll be out in 4 months and actively, you know, participating in education and the future plans that he has. But nobody is angry at CZ anymore, seemingly, which is very, very different than a year or two ago.
Yeah, I think that we do sometimes need different examples of things that were once grouped together to understand that there are big differences, right? And Sam and what he did just stands in such radical contrast to a huge portion of crypto bad behavior that we've seen, with CZ being emblematic thereof. And I think that as adults, we're able to tell the difference and make different judgments because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. But now we obviously have to talk about another crypto legend, for better or for worse, obviously, Roger Ver, aka Bitcoin Jesus. United States is pretty angry at this guy. They were so angry that they bothered to have him arrested in Spain, right? And worked with the Spanish government to do so. There's a lot of nuance to this story. Obviously, Roger Ver himself is one of the early proponents of Bitcoin, one of the most outspoken advocates for Bitcoin itself. That changed in the block wars when they hard forked Bitcoin Cash, which he believed was the future of Bitcoin, leaving him very unpopular with early Bitcoiners. More interestingly, in 2014, he decided to denounce his United States citizenship. He left, got citizenship elsewhere. He paid whatever he needed to pay and left. But in 2017, two companies apparently that he still had in the United States transferred Bitcoin that he had never reported to him personally, which he sold for upwards of $200 million. Apparently lied about this on his tax forms, etc. Very confusing story. Part of you wants to support him because he exited the United States. It was 2014. Nobody was thinking about Bitcoin. But if he literally evaded taxes and lied about it on his forms, you can understand why they would go after him. But it seems like they're really trying to make an example of an expat Bitcoiner for others who may think about trying the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think that the U.S. particularly likes people who renounce citizenship. I don't think that's a demographic that they're particularly worried about courting. And a lot of the policies show that, right? So the thing that's interesting about this story, to your point, Scott, is that there's so many dimensions of the way that people are discussing it. One dimension is the ethics of this entire category of taxes, right? It's the rest of the world tends not to have things that are sort of this egregious. And so it's sort of strange on that level. So a lot of people are talking about that. Then, of course, there is the personality story around Roger. And in addition to the block wars, there are people who, you know, like Dan Held, who feel like this guy has personally gone after them and used extremely aggressive tactics during these things. And so they will never forgive him. And so they don't care what he's being arrested for, basically. It's sort of, you know, throw him away and lock the key, or, you know, and lose the key. The other take, which is more from the crypto legal class, is, boy, was this flagrant, at least as it appears. If the sort of facts of the case are as alleged in the complaint, it is a pretty flagrant violation and pretty clear-cut tax evasion, where, you know, he basically just didn't tell his accountants about these entire big categories of assets that he had. Now, to your point, I think it is a reasonable question, which a judge will eventually be dealing with, you know, around how much consideration there was for Bitcoin back then. But listen, he didn't tell them because it was worth something. So it's a tough one, I think.
Yeah, back then, I've said, even when I got into crypto in 2016, and then in 2017, there was this widespread belief that you didn't have to even report it. It wasn't a real asset. There were no taxes. We've seen they haven't even changed the wash sale rule yet, that they were way behind. So in his mind, maybe he believed that, but it's very hard to make the jump to, I sold $250 million worth of something and don't think that I should mention that. The thing is, he wasn't a citizen anymore when he sold it.
Yeah. No, it's legally complex, for sure.
Yeah,
or at least legally complex. From the outside. Look at what do I know? Maybe it's actually incredibly legally clear.
And then, as you said, there's this interesting sort of nuance of a class of Bitcoiners. I'm not talking about Dan because Dan, this is like a personal situation for him, but a general class that because Roger did what he did to Bitcoin in the end, don't care what the government does to him, whether it is right or wrong. And that reeks of them cheering against Ripple or against Ethereum, literally cheering for the SEC when they're supposed to be libertarians. And now the chickens have come home to roost because they're going after Bitcoin self-custody, the very same entities. So, you know, it's kind of like the old poem, they came for the communists, but I did nothing because I wasn't a communist. They came for, you know, and then they came for me and there was nobody to speak for me.
We should mention too, because I didn't when I was kind of laying out the different camps, that relative to that group, there have also been a huge number of Bitcoin, you know, early adopters, OGs, who are on the other side of Roger in the block wars, who have made statements, if not in support of him, you know, against sort of this sort of policy, basically saying exactly that, that they're never going to cheer for this, that we shouldn't be cheering for this. Some have pointed out and shared personal stories of Roger being a good person behind the scenes. Peter McCormick talked about Roger offering to pay his legal defense fees against, you know, against Craig Wright. So, you know, they're actually, we shouldn't sort of paint it too much with the monoculture. I think that that slant of the sort of Bitcoin hypocrisy crowd is, you know, always a frustrating thing to see. But in this case, frankly, probably more a bigger portion of the early adopters than I might have thought came to, again, like, if not the defense of Roger, at least a, you know, let's not cheer this on, guys, kind of a statement.
Yeah. And a lot of the biggest names and some of the earliest names throughout time have now been punished effectively for, you know, believing this from the very beginning. It makes me think of my friend Charlie Shrem, obviously, who took the first bullet for the industry and went to jail all the way back then. Next story, Coinbase integrates Bitcoin's Lightning Network in partnership with Lightspark. We've been talking about this forever. It actually happened. Does this matter?
It matters in a similar way, not the same way, but a similar way to the ETFs, as we discussed, which is what matters is that it exists. It's now available. It gives people the chance to do this should they so want. It means that we are not technologically constrained. We are not structurally constrained from using Lightning. Will it mean that all of a sudden more liquidity is going to flood into Lightning channels? Not immediately, but Coinbase being in Lightning is a non-insignificant event. This is a, you know, the sort of default user-friendly UI, particularly for American crypto users. It's you know, in general, the first exchange alongside, you know, maybe Kraken or Gemini that that American users try. And so, yeah, supporting Lightning is a big deal, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't bring it up here. I'm going to just slide it over because now that I mentioned Coinbase, I think we have to talk briefly about Coinbase earnings yesterday because they absolutely smashed. Absolutely smashed. $1.64 billion in revenue versus $1.34 billion expected. But the bigger number was the earnings per share expectation. They did $4.40 per share, which was the $1.09 average analyst estimate. They 4X'd the estimate on earnings per share. Obviously, most of this just comes from Bitcoin raging.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But I mean, Coinbase is absolutely crushing it, and Wall Street gets it horribly wrong every single time.
It's what's super clear is that Wall Street just does not understand how to, they don't know how to look at Coinbase as both a financial institution that deals with types of numbers that they understand, and also a crypto institution that deals with a bunch of stuff they don't understand. I think where you're going to see this again in the future is when they start to try to explain the fees that they're making from Base. You know, that is going to be a whole new boondoggle for Wall Street that they just won't get. And the cool news for crypto native investors is that it means that it's very likely, I think, over the next 5 years plus, that there will often be price dislocations when it comes to Coinbase specifically because of Wall Street just misunderstanding where it is and being 6 months behind the eight ball on how they should be pricing it.
Yeah, they think it's just a crypto exchange and don't understand that there's a much deeper business there and there's much more nuance. So I just keep buying coin and hope for the best. Interestingly, it went down overnight on the good news after hours, which was kind of interesting to see, but they tend to get it wrong. final story is stablecoins. We obviously had, strangely, Maxine Waters touting progress on the stablecoin bill. We talked about this, I believe, last week. And then there was this belief that it might actually get wrapped into the FAA bill, but that has now had cold water poured on it. So now, little optimism that we do get stablecoin legislation in the immediate future. I still can't imagine we see anything on this before the election. Just seems like there would be no political motivation or will to do so from either side. But we are getting a serious uptick here in conversation about stablecoin bills again.
The analysis that I've seen, which sort of resonates, is one, this FAA bill was one of the sort of last chance must pass type bills that you could tack things onto. And when they decided to push that forward as a clean bill, which, by the way, there's a whole separate conversation about why we should be, you know, maybe enthusiastic about more clean bills going through and just being voted on the basis of the main thing. But, you know, the next one that has that you could tack this type of thing onto is the Defense Authorization Act coming up, you know, much later in the fall. So there's this big in-between period where it doesn't seem that there's likely to be a lot of movement. Now, one counterweight to that potentially is that Sherrod Brown, who is historically one of the big obstacles in the Senate, he's really focused on this marijuana banking legislation. He really wants to get that done. He's in a very tightly contested race. The marijuana legislation is something that he views as extremely popular for his base. And so he actually does have a personal political incentive to try to, if he can get the compromise deal that he wants, to try to push this as a set of things forward even before those elections, because he wants to be able to campaign on it. So there are some interesting kind of nuances there. However, proving once again that crypto should not be obsessed with their heroes, even in the Congress and the Senate, especially for those who think that there's some libertarian set of people running around. There's big swaths of the stablecoin supporting legislation, senators and congressmen and women who will not support marijuana banking legislation because it's marijuana, and who are taking every chance they can to be pissed off about it being reclassified. It's just a stupid display of hypocrisy that shows that these people are not our allies when it comes to actual beliefs. They just sometimes happen to agree with the same stuff we do when it comes to crypto, and we should never treat it as anything other than that.
I think that's a perfect way to wrap it up, guys. That was the Friday 5. Hopefully it won't be the Friday 1.5, as he said. Maybe we'll get some. I think that Bitcoin has actually risen while we've been talking. I haven't looked, but I'm checking the comments. People are saying 61.5. So I'll take that as a good win if things are actually bouncing at the moment. I still expect a very boring summer, but maybe they'll prove me wrong, guys. Follow the breakdown, NLW, of course, and we will be back next week with another Friday 4.5.
Later, guys.
Thanks, guys.